Welcome to episode 593 of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace. This is the New Comics Wednesday episode for November 14th, 2018. Apologize for it being a little bit late, but the reason for that is there's a ton of books, so many great books, and I still had to trim some. I'm not going to talk about a couple of the DC books I read, nor am I going to talk about Patience, Conviction, Revenge from Aftershock, because I just had to narrow it down. And that being said, you know, usually I talk about four or five books, maybe six, seven to stretch it. Today, let's see, 2, 4, 6, 8, 10, 12, 14 books that I just had to talk about. I couldn't cut down any further than this. Plus, there's the Black Order from Marvel. There's Uncanny X-Men, number one from Marvel. Those are both number ones. We also have Fantastic Four, number three. So there's a lot of great stuff from Marvel as well. So as you know, I don't get advanced copies from Marvel. So those will be talked about on Marvel Monday. Obviously, I'll do a full-in deep dive on Uncanny X-Men, number one. I think it's something ridiculous, like 72 pages, 68 pages, something like that. So we'll devote a whole spotlight on this coming Tuesday to that. So we make sure that we dive into everything and give the book its due and enough time for it to shine on its own. So if you're looking for Marvel stuff, as usual, look to Marvel Monday coming up next week. That would be on November 19th. So let me go ahead and dive into the books to cover this time. Because I'm covering so many, I'm going to try to keep my comments brief. As you know, I always say that, or I sometimes say that, and then I end up rattling on for, you know, an hour and a half. So I'm hoping to keep this short for all of you, you know, 30 minutes or so, cover the books just in the, you know, most high level. Obviously, no spoilers, and it'll give you an idea of what to look for when you hit your comic shop today. And again, apologize for it being late. I do typically like to have the New Comics Wednesday episode out by 6 a.m. Eastern on Wednesdays, so that those of you who stop in on your lunch hour, live on the East Coast, or maybe even stop in on your way to work, have a chance to know what's out there. But again, it was a busy weekend, a lot to cover, and interviews with creators and such. And there were so many good books that I wanted to read, and it just really put me behind. So anyway, let's start with Catwoman number 5. This is from the creative team of writer and artist Joelle Jones. We have Laura Allred on colors. We've got Josh Reed on letters, and then a couple of covers. We've got Jones and Allred on the regular cover, and then Art Germ on the variant cover. So a couple quick thoughts on Catwoman number 5. I like the narrative that Jones has been telling as far as Catwoman's emotional state and how affected she's been by kind of leaving Bruce at the altar, so to speak, and kind of waiting to see Jones's story tie back into what we saw at the end of Batman 50, spoilers for Batman 50 if you haven't read it, with Bane on that last page. And Catwoman clearly knew something was going on. We found out, you know, in these pages here, she feels betrayed by Holly. We haven't seen her start to explore that or tie back in, but we have had her dealing with this governor's mansion storyline, the governor's wife, who clearly has sinister intentions, you know, and we see her do something in this issue, which is pretty horrific. But at the end of the day, we get Catwoman kind of fed up with it, and I feel kind of the same way, right? Like, I feel like this group of antagonists, this governor's wife and her sons, aren't really worthy to really stand up to Catwoman. And if it wasn't for Catwoman being in a little bit of a diminished state, you know, being really tired, not being able to sleep because of what happened with Bruce, I feel like Catwoman would wipe the floor with them. And it seems like in this issue, we've hit kind of a turning point to the, we've gotten to the point where Catwoman's like, okay, you know what? Enough of you being a little irritant to me. Now you piss me off and I'm going to squash you. And I like that because I kind of feel the same way about these villains. I'm like, who are they to stand up to Catwoman, please? a little too big for their britches in a way, and they're about to get stomped on and well-deserved, and I can't wait to see them get their comeuppance. As far as art, you know, it's Joelle Jones on art and Laura Allred on color, so it's a bit heavier, I feel like, as far as line work and darker a little bit in color and tone than I'm used to seeing from Joelle. But again, it kind of suits the story just because of Catwoman's sort of her state of mind right now. So I have been enjoying Catwoman, maybe not as much as I expected to, but I feel like that has a lot to do with these antagonists in this story. I feel like they're just really not that interesting. They're a little mustache twirling, and they're not up to the caliber that I would expect to challenge Catwoman. You know what I mean? Like I feel like she needs some villains that'll really challenge her and push her, so that you kind of feel the stakes. I feel like, as I've said, Catwoman's been a little distracted with everything that's been going on in her personal life, and that's the only reason she hasn't absolutely crushed these people so far. But I'm looking forward to that crushing happening very soon. So, all right, next up we have Detective Comics from writer James Robinson. We have art by Carmine Di Gian Domenico, colors by Ivan Placencia, letters by Rob Lee. We've got Di Gian Domenico and Placencia on the regular cover, and then Mark Brooks on the variant cover. This is continuing the Two-Face storyline that Robinson is doing in Detective before Pete Tomasi takes over on the title. And it's been kind of interesting. This is the penultimate issue. It's really shown just how heroic Two-Face could be if he were to really want to turn the corner. Robinson doesn't really write Two-Face as insane as other writers, like maybe like a Scott Snyder would. And so it's a bit of a different take on the character. And I suppose you can chalk it up to the fact that Harvey Dent and his Two-Face, the Harvey Dent personality and the Two-Face personality are always kind of at war with each other for dominance of his mind, basically. And so at different times, depending on who is more in control or how much control Harvey Dent himself is able to exert on the mind of Two-Face, you can kind of use that as a gauge for how insane he is, right? So not that there needs to be an explanation or I need to be the one to give it, but if you want one, like, well, why does Two-Face act so crazy sometimes and other times he's more sane, you can look to that as somewhat of an explanation. But I do find it somewhat interesting and fun to see Two-Face and Bruce Wayne team up, because again, it shows just how formidable Two-Face Harvey Dent can be if he chooses to be on the side of angels. And, you know, he doesn't do anything out of the goodness of his own heart. And so seeing Two-Face and Batman team up to go against Cobra, which is kind of the reason that Two-Face is willing to team up with Batman. It's like the enemy of my enemy is my friend, you know? And so that's pretty much what's going on here. But I don't know that Batman would be quite so eager. I mean, not that he's eager to team up, but I guess it goes back to just how close Harvey and Commissioner Gordon and Batman were. You know, there was a time when they really did work together to clean up Gotham, and I imagine some of those feelings still exist for Bruce. And he comes right out and says at various times in this issue how he won't be fooled again. You know, there's been so many times where he's felt that he could rescue Harvey Dent from Two-Face and, you know, cure him basically. But that ship has sailed. He's learned his lesson after being burned so many times. But it is an interesting story. What exactly Cobra has planned, we learn in toward the end of this issue, and we have one more issue to go in the story to kind of give us an idea of how exactly Batman and Two-Face are going to thwart that plan. So I've really been enjoying the last couple of story arcs on Detective, both the Brian Edward Hill story arc and now the James Robinson story arc. So I hope that when Pete Tomasi comes on, that level of quality can continue, because it's been a really great ride so far. All right, next book I'm going to talk about is my book of the week. This kind of surprised me. That it was not that it was good, but that I it ended up being so much better than everything else because, as I said, you know, there were so many good books. I'm talking about 14 of them in this episode. And so, you know, a lot of really, really great titles, you know, Mr. Miracle number 12 and just all kinds of really great stuff, right? Hawkman number 6. But my book of the week is actually Electric Warriors number 1. It absolutely blew me away from the story to the art, the world that Steve Orlando, the writer, is creating. It was stunningly good, and I want to pick it as my book of the week, give it a little bit of a signal boost. I want to be sure that a lot of you out there listening pick it up. It's definitely worth your time. And, you know, a title like this, it doesn't necessarily have, you know, any kind of iconic name, doesn't have Batman in it, you know, doesn't have Superman in it, no Justice League here, but you do yourself a favor and pick it up because it's a really, really fun comic. So it's from writer Steve Orlando. As I mentioned, the art is by Travel Foreman. The colors are by Hi-Fi. The letters are by Travis Lanham. We have a cover by Foreman and Hi-Fi, and then a variant cover by Bengal. So I'm not going to spoil the final page reveal that had me going, holy crap. It's really awesome. There's a character that shows up at the end there that I didn't expect. But just to give you kind of an idea of what's going on, right? So it's definitely set in the future. And it's after kind of the time of Commandy, which we know at that point animals had kind of gained sentience, and they were able to, due to this chemical or medicine or whatever you want to call it, cortexin, which allowed animals to kind of evolve and be upright and everything. And they kind of took over, and the humans were the kind of the subjugated species. So we've moved beyond that now. It seems that there's has been some agreements between humans and animals, and they're trying to live in harmony, so to speak. But as with anything, it's easier said than done. There are those that still feel the resentment of being subjugated, and even those that didn't necessarily live through it, but there are those that don't trust animals. And so it's not exactly the kind of the socio-political environment is not exactly hunky dory. Let's say there's a lot of upheaval. There's a lot of things to be determined and different factions that are looking for justice in different ways. So that's kind of the backdrop of the story that Orlando starts to tell. And then we get so much of context, you know, being in the future, looking back on the past, the age of heroes. We get interesting characters who, you know, we learn about other animals that have evolved. Again, I don't want to give too much away because I want you to read it and enjoy it for yourself. But so much of what Orlando does is take aspects of those animals and logically evolves them to the point where the way they communicate and the way they relate to each other, it makes perfect sense that they would act in those ways. And then we also have within this environment of these animals with certain abilities and this unrest in terms of social strata between animals and humans and all that, you've got a family drama as well with people within the same family who don't agree or really have the same kind of philosophical outlook on what should be done as far as the way to deal with the unrest and should we accept it? Should we be looking for peace? Should there be some other fallout? And then on top of all that, you've got this concept that war doesn't really exist anymore. It's more like choosing a champion. That's what an electric warrior is. So you have all these different races and beings throughout the galaxy. And rather than have some kind of war, if there's some kind of conflict or any kind of something that needs to be decided, you send your world's electric warrior up against another world's electric warrior. And the battle takes place. And then, you know, the victor is the one who wins the fight, obviously, and things are settled that way. So that's kind of the premise of the whole Electric Warrior part of it. But it seems so simplistic, and even as I'm explaining it to you, I realize it sounds kind of dry, and there's all these disparate parts, and it doesn't seem like they all go together. But it blends together so seamlessly. There's so many big ideas in this book. And being that it's, you know, a possible future of the DC universe, it's always fun to peek into that and see different aspects of, you know, a different future for the DCU. And it just ends up becoming this incredible story, right? And I think that when you look at writers like Grant Morrison, who's, you know, obviously immensely popular, you know, a legend in the industry, I'm not a big Grant Morrison fan, because I feel like a lot of times he himself, much like Orlando in this book, has a lot of big ideas and he throws everything out there and it's cosmic and it's fun. But the problem I have with Morrison is so much of his dialogue and so many of those ideas seem so matter of fact. I feel like it's not necessarily explain, because I'm sure in his mind it makes perfect sense, but maybe I'm not smart enough to understand it. It seems so dense. There's such a huge barrier to entry. He makes it hard to understand the concepts that he's going for. It's not always the case, because in All-Star Superman, I feel like he did a great job, and there were some ideas there and some fun stuff that was just kind of thrown on the page. You know, you were thrown in the deep end of the pool and it worked. That worked for me. But there have been other times where it hasn't worked. But I think Orlando is doing something similar here, because he's introducing all these great ideas, just like Morrison does, right? Like all these great cosmic ideas, and you're kind of forced to pick it up through context of the story, the background and kind of what these ideas mean. But I feel like, and it's not that there's a ton of exposition, and it's not like Steve is hitting us over the head with these ideas, but I just feel like in the way he scripted the book, we can pick up things a lot easier than we can when Morrison does it. And so I just felt like it kind of reminded me of a Grant Morrison book, in that there were all these awesome ideas. I kept going, man, Steve, this stuff's out there, man. But it's really cool. But I also understood it so much more than sometimes I do in a Grant Morrison book. And again, maybe it's me. Maybe I just don't, quote unquote, get Grant Morrison. Maybe I'm not smart enough to get Grant Morrison. But I get Steve Orlando, and I get Electric Warriors number one. And it's the ideas are fascinating. It's really fun. And if you only pick up one book today, it's got to be this one. I mean, obviously, you're going to pick up Mr. Miracle number 12 if you've been reading that all along. And there's a ton of great books, man. But I had to pick this for my book of the week, because it was so, it completely exceeded my expectations. And it so far exceeded my expectations that it surprised me. You know, I pick up just about everything Steve Orlando does and writes, because I think he's a great writer, and I know he has such a love for obscure DC characters, and I do too. And so that's, you never know who's going to show up in a Steve Orlando book, DC book. So I always try to at least take a peek. But again, this completely blew me away, and I was just so surprised by how excellent it was. And not only on the writing side of things, the art by Travel Foreman, for me, this is by far and away the best art of Travel Foreman's career. I don't know if he's doing something differently, but the look and feel of it, it has, maybe he's working digitally, because it has almost a digital painted quality. You know, I the first time I ever saw Travel Foreman's art was on Animal Man, the new 52 Animal Man. And that was somewhat of a different style than this. It was a little rougher. This is so much more polished and clean, very fine lines. And it completely blew me away. And I have to also mention the color work by Hi-Fi. Again, Brian and Christy Miller, incredible color artists, always have been, very professional, very solid. Like, their work is always really great, traditional comic coloring. They've gone a step above on this one. And again, I don't know if it's because this is kind of the tone of the feel they're going for. But again, it does have that sort of painted quality. The colors aren't super primary, but they're very, very beautiful. A lot of bright colors, greens and purples and pinks. And it really helps to set the tone and the mood of this wonder. There's this wonder feel to the future, right? And it's it's interesting because it's very juxtaposed with this class struggle that's going on, right? Like, this isn't a future that's like all bright and happy and sunshiny. Color-wise, it is, but the story kind of belies that. And so you've got these colors that Brian and Christy use that are, you know, are so bright and set a tone and set a mood, and it's this bright, advanced technological future with, you know, animals and that are, you know, sentient, upright, and walking, and all that works really, really well. But again, it's that class struggle juxtaposed with the brightness of color, and yeah, it really, really surpassed all my expectations. So incredible job. Kudos to the entire creative team. I was blown away. So definitely my book of the week is Electric Warriors number one. All right. Next up, we have The Flash number 58. This is from writer Joshua Williamson. We have pencils by Rafa Sandoval, inks by Jordi Tarragona, colors by Tameyu More, letters by Steve Wands. We've got Sandoval, Tarragona, and More on the regular cover, and Carl Kerschel on the variant. So this is Force Quest number one. We saw at the end of Flash 57, Barry and Iris decided to go on a journey to try to discover what exactly the other forces are. Barry's confronted the strength force that the trickster was infected with, and then the sage force, which Heatwave was infected with. And he realizes that he needs to learn more about the current state of the speed force, and the flashes of the 52 worlds kind of implore him to do that, as well as hoping to discover more about the strength force and the sage force, as well as these new forces that are rumored to be out there. And he knows he can't do that sitting back in his comfort zone in Central City. He's got to get out there and explore. So it's kind of a setup issue in a way. Like, the first few pages of the book were kind of, Williamson is using that to kind of show us, I don't want to say the new status quo, but how this change, which is a pretty big change for Barry, how this change has affected him, right? It's something new and different for Flash, I feel like. So often Flash is rooted in Central City, rooted in his hometown and kind of his support system. And so it's great to see Williamson kind of get Barry out of his comfort zone. He still has Iris as sort of his anchor, or his lightning rod, to put it in Flash terms. But at one point, he even talks about running back to Central City. It'll only take a second, right? And Iris is like, no, we agreed that we would only go back to Central City, even if it was only for a few minutes, as an emergency. This is something we need to do. So it's really getting Barry out of his comfort zone and getting him to get back to school and get back to learning, is how Barry himself frames it in the first few pages. He's got to learn what these forces are, if he and the Justice League are able to figure out a way to not have them negatively affect the DC universe. So that's kind of the first part of the story, is seeing Barry and Iris and kind of set up this kind of the rules, so to speak, for this road trip. And then Barry and Iris confront a couple of new villains that they look like they perhaps might be out looking for Speed Force artifacts, or I shouldn't say Speed Force, but just Force artifacts themselves. They seem to be on a similar kind of journey of Barry and Iris. And then we end the issue in another kind of surprise place, when Barry starts to accept the fact that, yes, I've got to do this Force quest. I've got to stop trying to predict things and see where things will go, and just start kind of going with the flow. And I need to just go where I feel called to by these forces. And when Barry does that, when he opens himself up to just kind of let I'm not sure if it's the Speed Force or if it's the call of another one of the forces, but when he kind of lets himself go and just say, okay, I'm going to let this quest take me where it will, he ends up in a place a classic Flash location. We've seen him many times before, but things there are not exactly in a good place. things there look like something bad has gone down. So that's kind of, you know, again, being super vague, I don't want to spoil, but that's kind of where we are with Flash. And Williamson has been on this title since the beginning, and it feels like he really is telling an epic Flash story, and it's a lot of fun. It's a lot of fun to be on this ride. I don't know that I've ever seen Rafa Sandoval draw Flash before, but I think he does a really good job of showing movement with Barry. And, you know, he's a great artist. I always loved his work on Green Lantern. The rest of the creative team does a great job as well. The colors are a little bit muted. I'm used to a little bit brighter reds and yellows in a Flash comic. And I'm pretty sure I've seen Tameyu Morae do work on Flash before. So I'm a little surprised. I'm not sure why they've chosen to go a little bit more subdued with the colors. That's not to say there aren't some bright yellows, because there are times where Morae does an excellent job of that lightning, both coming off of Barry as he runs, as well as the yellow lightning on his costume. I always love it when colorists are able to make it look like it's actually glowing in two dimensions there coming off the page. That's a really great job. And also I have to mention Jordi Tarragona on the inks, really great line weights. And, I think that Jordi teams up with Rafa quite frequently, and they're a great team. So all in all, a really fun book and a really great starting point. If you're not reading Flash, but you're interested in it, this is a great place to jump on. I don't think you really need to know much, if anything, that's gone on previously in Flash. You can pick it up pretty easily from the context of the conversations between Barry and Iris, and it leads itself to a great issue for anybody who wants to jump on Flash going forward. All right, next up we have Hawkman number 6. Hope you all enjoyed Hawkman Day and our special Hawkman Day episode that we did with writer Robert Venditti, talking about just how awesome Hawkman has been and how great it's been for him and Brian Hitch to be working on the title. The creative team for this book, the aforementioned Robert Venditti writing, Brian Hitch on pencils, Hitch inks himself for the entirety of this issue 6, and we have Jeremiah Skipper on colors, Starkings, and Comic Craft on letters. So this is the second part of the Fury and the Titan. It's the Atom and Hawkman teaming up in the Microverse to continue Hawkman's journey to discover who he is. You know, he realizes that he has been reincarnating across time and space for the entirety of his life. And he seems to have, in previous lives, left himself clues both to who he is. And I don't know if he knew that he was going to eventually forget and need to rediscover himself, or if he's just leaving himself clues and weapons in order to fight the Deathbringers, which we see Hawkman specifically mention in this issue that, yes, the Deathbringers are coming and they are a huge threat. And we may even get a glimpse of the Deathbringers in this issue, perhaps right at the end. So again, it's been a really, really fun ride. It's great to see Robert Venditti taking old ideas, new ideas, mixing them together. And the thing, and I told this to Rob when we had him on the show last, the thing about this Hawkman title that is most evident, is most obvious, it's just how much fun Brian Hitch and Rob are having on this title. They're having an absolute blast, the time of their lives, and that passion and enjoyment that the creators are having on the title really comes through in the pages. And Hawkman, I mean, there's never been a better Hawkman story. I'm so invested in this. It's so compelling. And I can't, every issue I read, it's like, man, I cannot wait for the next one, because there are so many great little tidbits in here. And there's one thing that happens in here, the stash of nth metal that Hawkman detected in the Microverse, the whole reason he's there, when he goes and digs it up, it's not exactly what he expected, but it leads to some incredible scenes with Hawkman, something that is so cool. And again, I don't want to spoil it, but man, it is really, really awesome. It's just one more time we're seeing the creativity of Robert Venditti come through, where he's taking a concept that we've seen so many times and he's putting a cool new spin on it. And not only has he been doing a great job, he did a great job of that in Green Lantern. And not only is he doing a great job of it in Hawkman, but it's cool because the little twists and spins that he puts on it, and the twist and spin he puts on this this classic trope in this issue, it's a Hawkman spin. It's a Hawkman twist. It's this what he does here, it wouldn't really work with any other hero as well as it works with Hawkman. And it ends up just being awesome. And so we get teased right at the very end on that last page that next issue is Origin. And Rob told us that himself while he was here, Seven is going to delve into the origin of Hawkman. He's a lot older than even he himself realizes. And then the much anticipated issue 8, the Kryptonian issue that I just cannot wait for. So incredible, incredible job. And last thing I'll say about Hawkman 6 is the art by Brian Hitch. Again, it's the best work of his career. I know I sound like a broken record here with all these comics and these artists doing the best work they've ever done, but it really is true. And it shows us that we're really in a golden age of comics and comic creators right now. And I'm not the only one that thinks this is Brian Hitch's best work. He himself was tweeting out on Hawkman Day about how inspired he's been by looking at some of the old Hawkman artists, particularly Joe Kubert, and how it's been so inspiring to Brian that he's been able to kind of let it go a little bit and let himself feel a little more free as an artist. And it's allowed him to work faster and allowed him to do work that's better than he's ever done. He's not overthinking it, right? He's just letting his pure, natural artistic talent come out on the page. And it really shows. It's been just an amazing, amazing book. And there are so many visuals each issue where you look at it and you're just like, wow, that's awesome. And usually those are a lot of times the same moments where Hawkman is doing something really cool. He's doing something unexpected, and it's such a cool moment. And I think he himself as a comic fan, right? Brian Hitch as a comic reader and enjoying these stories and some of these ideas he's coming with, you know, up with on his own. He's got to recognize how cool those moments are and how cool those ideas are, because those often are his best pages. Those are the pages where he is just letting it all hang out, man. And it's an incredible ride. So I hope you guys are all enjoying Hawkman. I really would love to see Hawkman numbers start to climb, which oftentimes will happen with a book that is so good and so many people are enjoying. The word of mouth of it can lead to increased numbers and increased circulation. That's exactly what we want for Hawkman. So be sure you're picking up Hawkman. All right, next up we have Bitterroot number 1. It's from the creative team of David F. Walker, Chuck Brown, and Sanford Green. They're all listed as creators. We've got Rico Renze and Sanford Green as the color artists, Clayton Cowles on letters. We've got Sanford Green and Drew Wimberly as the cover artists. So this is the story of, I guess you'd say, an African-American family in the 40s or so. And they're in Harlem, and they are charged with protecting society from demons and monsters. The Jinnu, as they're called in this, and it's a great evil that's plagued humanity since the very beginning, right? But the title Bitterroot, and this is evidenced by the essay in the back of the book from the creators, it's about that bitterroot of racism and disharmony that Black people have always felt in this world that we have, right? Racism is something that takes root and is very insidious and seems to be impossible to really eradicate. It's been in our past. It's here in our present, and it will probably exist in the future, unfortunately. So in a way, this story, this family who is out trying to stop this evil, which infects humans and turns them into monsters, it's really a metaphor for trying to fight racism and inequality and bigotry and persecution. And, you know, all those things, all those concepts are something we all have the capability of. We all have the capability to be racist, right? No matter what the color of your skin is, you have that capability inside you to be intolerant. That's the monster that's inside each of us. It's the monster that exists within both society as a whole and humanity as a whole, and also us individually as humans. We all have that capacity to do evil if that's the choice that we make. So this is a story where, as I said, that intolerance is the metaphor, is the monster. But it's framed in this sort of supernatural, high adventure story that these creators are telling. And at the end of the day, it's one of those stories that exists for a very good reason. You know, oftentimes I'll talk about how I feel so strongly about how fiction and the stories we tell reflect so much on the societies that tell them, right? So, and the era of the society. So if you go and look at a certain civilization and you want to learn about that civilization, you know, especially a civilization that's extinct, and you want to know, okay, who were they? And specifically, who were they at this particular time during this particular era? Go and look at the stories they told. Go and look at the fiction that they created at that time. And it so reflects what that society was at that time in terms of what was important to them, what were some of the themes and ideas that they wanted to explore. And Bitterroot is a perfect example of that. And it's why I love the comics medium. It's why I am so happy that the comics medium exists. And it's the perfect type of story for sequential storytelling, right? It's just another one of those stories that prove how important comics are, and why I feel like not enough people realize how important storytelling is, because it's not just the narrative, it's the pictures, it's the art, it's how we see ourselves and how that comes across on the page. And so often with sequential storytelling, you're able to elicit an emotional response from the reader based on not only the story you're telling narratively, but also the story you're telling visually, which then helps to elicit that emotional response and make it more impactful and strengthen that impact to the reader. And all those things are exactly why comics are important, why sequential storytelling is important, and why it's great that this medium exists, because you get to tell stories like the story that David Walker and Sanford Green and company are telling in Bitterroot. So if you're interested in those kind of themes, I do encourage you to pick it up. Sanford Green art is a little more of a cartoony style, but it certainly suits the tone of the story that these creators are trying to tell and the era that they're trying to tell it in. So, all right, next up, I'm going to talk about Cyberforce number 7. This is from writers Brian Edward Hill and Matt Hawkins. We've got art by Atilio Rojo, letters by Troy Pateri, and cover by Atilio Rojo. And we're still kind of in the early stages of Cyberforce, in as much as they're still kind of putting the team together, this kind of modern take on Cyberforce. Nobody's really using the code names. You know, we've got Aphrodite there. We've got Stryker. We've got Velocity, and they're not necessarily calling themselves that. We've met Ripclaw. We've met Warchild as kind of the antagonist. And the story, I don't want to say it's a slow burn, but what Hill and Hawkins are doing is they're letting the story breathe. They're moving it along at kind of a slower pace for us to really understand and feel the impact that the characters are feeling as they, I don't want to say as they lose their humanity, but as they're forced to make these choices for themselves and sometimes for others, the choice to become something more than human, right? And when we had Brian Edward Hill on to talk about Cyberforce before the first issue even came out, we talked about him and Matt wanting to explore that idea of transhumanism. You know, it's a theme that's explored a lot of times with Cyborg over in the DC universe, like how robotic can you go and still be human? Like at what point do you stop being human and you start being a machine? You know, where's the line between man and machine? And you've got to balance that with the sacrifices these kind of regular people are making to use these abilities once they have them, rather than just to retreat, right? Go hide somewhere, go wallow in self-pity, or, you know, just want to hide away from the world. They're still choosing to do good with these abilities, right? So we're almost watching them discover for themselves that they're heroes. And so it's been a fun ride so far. And I can't wait till there's about 20 issues of this thing out and be able to read it all as one long narrative. I think it's gonna read really well. So it's been a fun ride. The artwork by Attilio Rojo is absolutely outstanding, from the rendering, the anatomy, the transitions from panel to panel, the color work. All of it has been really excellent. If you haven't seen his art before, he is an extremely talented artist, great storyteller, and very impactful, great emotionality in his characters. And it's an absolute gorgeous book to look at, 100%, no doubt about it. All right, next book up is another one from Image. It's Gideon Falls, number 8. This is from writer Jeff Lemire, art by Andrea Sorrentino. We've got colors by Dave Stewart, letters by Steve Wants. And we've got I'm going to assume the regular cover is by Andrea Sorrentino, and then a variant cover by Jeff Lemire. And the regular cover is, man, it is gorgeous. It's all the Gideon Falls covers have been pretty good. A lot of the ones we've seen so far have been aerial maps, but when you look down on them, the way the map and the roads and buildings and everything are laid out by Sorrentino, they often create faces in the town of Gideon Falls. So it's been an interesting look at the covers. This one is birds, a flock of birds that's flying, but they also create a shape of a human face. And then we've got water in the background and a police car and the sun glinting off the water. It's just a gorgeous, gorgeous cover. So this is another one of those books, much like Black Eyed Kids, that show the power of horror, the tautness, the way you feel compelled to keep reading because you don't know what's going to happen next. We get a little bit of a flashback into more of Norton Sinclair's childhood, one of the main characters. We also see that Father Fred and Clara, the sheriff, are starting to have some ideas about how to unravel this mystery. It seems like they've come to accept that the Black Barn exists, and now it's on to discovering like why, what's its motivation. Claire wants to rescue her brother. She's starting to remember things that she previously had forgotten from her childhood that are turning out to be little breadcrumbs that are leading them hopefully down the path to find answers. So as this book has from the very beginning, Sorrentino's art is absolutely incredible in setting the mood and the tone. Is dirty horror, is that a word? It's not nice and neat and, you know, tied up with a bow and just, you know, follow the breadcrumbs and find answers. There's this sense of menace and this malevolency that kind of permeates the book. And you almost wonder as you're reading it, like, how do the characters not feel it as well? Or maybe they do, right? And that's what's motivating them to find the answers. So it's been an incredible book. I can't wait to see this thing get to the small screen. It's been picked up for TV, for television. And man, if they can capture that feel that Sorrentino brings with his art and Stewart brings with his colors, that malevolency to the point where, you know, I've talked about this before, right from the first issue that I talked about, is that sense of dread and that sense of horror exists like right from the start of the story. And even when it's daylight, it's scary because that tone and that feel is there. So, you know, I hear a lot of people talking about Gideon Falls, just how good it is. I don't know what the numbers actually are, but I hope it's doing really well numbers wise because it deserves it. It's an incredible book. And next time I see Jeff Lemire, or I'm going to try to reach out to him and get him to come on to talk about Gideon Falls, because Jeff's been on a few times to talk about different books, but never anything as dark or as scary as Gideon Falls. And I really want to pick his brain about it. Next book I'll mention is Infinite Dark number 2, speaking of horror books. This is from writer Ryan Caddy and artist Andrea Moody. We've got colors by K. Michael Russell, letters by Troy Pateri. And this is the story of what happens after the heat death of the universe when a few thousand humans have been able to survive on a space station. We had Ryan on to talk about the book before the first issue came out. First issue was awesome. Second issue really ratchets up not only the tension, but also the stakes, because we somewhat of the mystery of why things are happening is revealed. We don't necessarily know motivations, but we kind of learn that what's been going on in the station is a little more widespread than we thought. We also learn who is behind it, though we don't really know why. But what I love here is what a exceptional job Ryan Caddy, the writer, is doing in the interpersonal relationships and the emotion and the reactions and the interactions of all the human characters on the ship. It feels very realistic, the reactions that they have and the choices people are making, in terms of if they were in this incredible situation, unprecedented situation of being on this spaceship or space station after the end of the universe, surrounded literally by nothing, surrounded by the void, right? Complete entropy outside them, waiting for the universe to restart with the next big bang, and trying to, you know, hope that humanity can survive that, and the human race as a species can continue in a new universe. All those things are completely unprecedented, right? And I feel like Ryan's doing a great job of not only telling this suspenseful story and this horror story about the fact that even out there in the nothingness, there may in fact be something more horrific than we can ever imagine. But the story's got to be inhabited, you know, that story, that suspenseful story, that scary story has to be inhabited by characters that we care about, characters that act realistically, right, that we can relate to. And he's done an exceptional job with that. I don't think I've ever read anything by Ryan that was so invested in like the personality and the character of the actual characters, right? Like a lot of the stuff he's written before has been a little more action oriented, if I can get that word out. But this is something different from him, and he's really showing his skills as a writer in this book. So I do encourage you to pick it up. The art by Andrea Moody is excellent, as we've come to expect from him on things like Port of Earth and some of his other previous work. So this is a little more detailed than his work on Port of Earth, but he does a great job of injecting a sense of menace and a sense of foreboding into his characters. And a lot of high emotion panels, right? Like with the stakes being so high, the literally the survival of the human race kind of hinging on the survival of the people in this space station. Obviously, anything that goes wrong is you're going to have tensions and emotions running high. And Andrea does a great job of depicting that. Also, the colors by K. Michael Russell, they're a little muted. They're a little gloomy. And again, it helps to set the tone and the mood of this story very, very well. So great job from the entire creative team. All right, next up we have Rose, also from Image. This is from writer Meredith Finch. We have art by Ig Guara and colors by Triona Farrell, letters by Cardinal Ray. This has been a really fun story as well. The story of the Rose, the last guardian of this world where magic is outlawed, and her cat, her mystical being who's been captured. And Rose herself has been captured, and her friends are out to rescue her. But again, not everybody always has the same ideas of what's the best thing to do, how's the best path forward. We've got to rescue Rose, we've got to rescue Thorn, but what's the best way to do that? And what's the best way to free the land from the evil Queen Drusilla's rule? And not everyone is always going to agree. So in that way, much like a lot of the other titles that I've talked about today, Meredith Finch is giving us a realistic narrative. It's still rooted in fantasy, still rooted in strong female characters, but we're getting a little more complexity to the story. And it feels like we're almost there, maybe another issue or two, and we're going to get to the climax of the story, because things definitely seem like they're coming to a head. As far as the art goes from Iguara, it's been excellent right from the very beginning. His style is a little looser, but it certainly fits this sort of medieval fantasy world that Meredith is narrating here to give us the story. I would say this is probably the issue that Rose herself shows up the least amount. We don't really get much, if any, character growth or character arc for Rose in this issue. This issue is a lot about her companions and the sacrifices and choices they're making to try to not only save Rose, but try to save the kingdom as well. So it's nice every once in a while to get an issue like this, where we're getting some of the supporting characters spotlighted on, so we can kind of enrich the story with the supporting cast as well. So really enjoyed this issue. I've been enjoying Rose right from the start. It's a really great comic. I would recommend for like 12 to 14 year old girls specifically. Like, it's great for anybody. I'm really enjoying it, but I think specifically a 12 to 14 year old girl would really kind of see herself in Rose and see kind of the obstacles that she's had to overcome and kind of be able to relate to it that way. So if you are looking for something for a niece or a daughter or a granddaughter for Christmas, you could do a lot worse than picking up Rose. Another book that would make a great Christmas gift is Skyward from writer Joe Henderson, art by Lee Garbett, colors by Antonio Fabella, and letters by Simon Boland. We've got issue 8 hitting stands today from this creative team, and Willa and her companions are still on a quest to return gravity to normal. And we saw them get attacked by giant bugs over the last couple issues. They've found somewhat of a safe haven out in the forest, a plant that was initially made to process cows and send the food into the cities. So things have gone not quite as well as they may have hoped. And there's some choices that the people that work this factory have had to make. But the problem is the factory is part of Baro Agriculture, Baro being the guy that was Willa's partner, or Willa's father's partner, I should say. And he doesn't want gravity returned to normal. He's living the high life as things are now. And that's sort of the conflict and why he's been chasing Willa and why she fled the city in the first place. So a lot of drama, a lot of pieces being moved around on the board here in this particular issue. We see Willa not knowing who she can trust and not knowing how exactly she's going to continue on this quest that she set herself, this quest that she promised her father she would complete before he died. So we do get somewhat of a cliffhanger ending. I'm very interested to see where it goes next, but the story has definitely shifted to a little bit of a darker tone, a little bit more conspiracy, and a little bit more danger inherent in the story, as opposed to the first arc, which was somewhat establishing Willa as this happy-go-lucky character, and it was bright and fun, and really, really loved it. And now with the death of her father and this very important mission that she set for herself, the narrative of the story has changed somewhat, and I'm really enjoying kind of the the tautness and the suspense and somewhat of the mystery and wondering who Willa can trust along with herself as she's wondering in the story, what to do, who can I trust, who should I tell? So it's a great story. We've had Joe Henderson on the show to talk about it a few times. Hope you have listened to those interviews and enjoyed it. Hope you're picking up Skyward. The color work by Antonio Fabella is pretty impressive, I'll say, as well, just because, as I mentioned, he did such a great job of keeping everything bright and light in the first story arc. And a lot of the more somber tone and mood we feel in this second arc is due to the color choices he's making, and it's very complimentary to the story. Also, the pencil work by Lee Garbett, the art, I mean, it's absolutely incredible. You know, talk to Lee at New York Comic Con about the challenge of drawing things that nobody else has ever drawn before, right? A world without gravity, where you've got to always be aware of your backgrounds and make sure you don't have things, you know, just resting on tables, you know, everything floats. And so, you've got to, it's a constant challenge, and Garbett has done an incredible job. And it's almost like he's created new ways for characters to interact with body language and stuff because everybody's flying, right? It's an incredible job by Lee and the rest of the creative team as well. All right, up next we have Thief of Thieves from the creative team of writer Brett Lewis. We have art by Sean Martinborough, colors by Adriana Lucas, and letters by Russ Wooten. And those last three, Sean, Adriano, and Russ, have been on this Thief of Thieves title from the beginning, so that's pretty awesome. I'm not going to say a whole lot about this issue other than, man, the story that Brett Lewis is telling is one of those heist stories that's really fun and really cool, but it's so dense. There's so much dialogue here, because this is not, you know, tights and capes. It's something completely different than that, and it's something that so heavily hinges on being able to understand all these different tricks and machinations and different narratives and scenarios that Redman and his team are setting up to kind of trick their mark, so to speak. And so this is going to be one of those where once it's all done, once issue 43 comes out, I'll have to go back and reread it a couple times just to get everything there is out of the story, because I think there is so much there. But what's interesting is, as much as there's all these cool tricks and different events that Redman is using to defeat his enemies, at the end of the day, like some of the other books I've talked about, if we don't care about the characters and we don't care about the relationships, then the book can just fall flat, right? But the action is not only being ramped up in terms of approaching the end of the story, and so the, you know, Redman's plans are coming to a head, but also dramatically in terms of the relationships of the characters, that action, that drama is being ratcheted up, as well as people have doubts about who they can trust. And, you know, ultimately these are all criminals that we're rooting for as the protagonist here, but, you know, a criminal by nature is somewhat of a liar, right? They're doing things that they shouldn't be doing. They're not exactly honest. And so that leads to a lack of trust between these characters, which then leads to drama, which then can lead to problems with executing the plan. And so it's all wrapped up in this big, dense narrative that that Brett Lewis is telling. And even though this is only a 32-page comic, it just felt like there was so much story here. And so I do recommend Thief of Thieves. And when it's all said and done, not only will I go back and reread the Brett Lewis stuff in one sitting, I'll probably go back and read Thief of Thieves from the beginning to the end, because it's been a really great title from Skybound, you know, based on a Robert Kirkman idea. And again, probably one of those that's flying a little bit under the radar. Rumors of it being turned into a TV show early on, unfortunately, never came to fruition. And I really wish it would, because I think this book would really be great to see as maybe a 3 or 4 or 5 issue, or five season series on Netflix, to get a look at Redman and his team and all the different things that they go through to ultimately see how he ends up, right? Does he finally get to leave the life behind, or will he even make it out alive? Like, all that's yet to be determined. And Sean Martinborough, for his part, as an artist, and this goes for Lucas and Wooten as well, they've done such a great job visually of creating a book that so easily looks like it can translate to the small screen, to the point where you can lift shots right from the book, right? Like take a panel and be like, yep, that's a shot. That's a shot. That's a shot. I mean, it's so, you know, I hate to throw the word cinematic out there. It's used far too often to refer to comic art, in my opinion, but it really is appropriate in this case. All right. Next book I'm going to talk about is Bloodshot Rising number 1. It's from writers Zach Thompson and Lonnie Nadler, with a script by Kevin Grievous. We have pencils by Ken Lashley, finishes by Ryan Wynn with Brian Thies and Oliver Borges, colors by Diego Rodriguez, and letters by Simon Boland. All I'm going to say about Bloodshot Rising is this is a whole new ballgame. We're flashing back to try to understand the origins of Bloodshot, but we're still not necessarily getting straightforward answers, right? It's not like this book starts off and say, and we find out, okay, here's who Bloodshot actually was. Here's the soldier he was. Here's the hitman he was. Here's the person he was. Here's how he got to Project Rising Spirit. Here's what happened when he got injected with the nanites. We're still unsure, right? These writers are still giving us just enough of a mystery to kind of wonder, okay, who is Bloodshot really, right? And what I'm most excited for about this series is to see the evolution of a hero, right? To see this guy get injected with the nanites, and whether we ever get a definitive answer of who he is or not, to see him overcome that programming that Project Rising Spirit tries to inject in him, because basically his innate heroic nature wins out over any sort of programming or computerized nanite influence or whatever. So in this issue, we're getting one possible background for him that they're trying to apply. Whether or not it has some roots in truth or not, we don't know. But it is sufficiently bloody and action-packed, and it's very worthy of the Bloodshot title. So great art by Ken Lashley. You know, talked to Robert Myers several times. I've heard him talk about how perfect Ken Lashley is for a book like this that has so many weapons rooted in modern day military hardware and such. And, you know, it's blood, it's guns, it's bullets. And speaking of bullets, there's a great scene in issue 1 with Bloodshot and bullets. And I won't spoil it for you, but that one scene itself is almost worth the price of the comic. It was really, really cool and inventive. And I really enjoyed Bloodshot Rising Spirit. I was worried, being that Jeff Lemire had been the only one to work on Bloodshot for quite a while, and the story he told of breaking Bloodshot down and then putting him back together was so poignant and compelling, and it added so much depth to the character, I almost was a little wary of stepping back, going back in time and talking about Bloodshot's origin. But based on the quality of the first issue, very impressed. I think that the whole creative team did a great job. And I feel really good about Bloodshot Rising Spirit going forward. All right, last book I'm going to talk about today is Ninjak number 13. It's from writer Christos Gage. We have art by Roberto De La Torre, colors by Jose Villarubia, letters by A Larger World Studios. And it's the penultimate issue of this arc. And we do get a resolution between Ninjak, the Dying One, and the Eternal Warrior, and that's interesting, right? Like, that part of the story is over, and yet the entire arc is not over. And what I find interesting about that is what we're coming to understand is this arc is more about Ninjak himself rather than the Dying One and the Eternal Warrior, right? Like, the mission may have been go and rescue the Eternal Warrior from the Dying One, but really what the overall story has been about is Ninjak. Who is Ninjak and who does he want to be, right? Like, he'll do anything for a friend, and he did agree to turn over Livewire to MI6. So they in turn could turn her over to the United States government. Like, Ninjak agreed to do that so that he could find out the location of Gilad, the Eternal Warrior, and go and rescue him. You know, he's loyal to his friends. He wants to go and rescue Gilad. But he made a deal to trade a friend for a friend, knowing all along he was going to try to find a way out of it. And now when it, you know, that part of the mission is over, he was able to rescue Gilad. And now he's faced with the choice of, who do I want to be? Who am I? Am I really the guy that would trade one friend for another? What's the answer, right? And if he does choose to turn over Livewire, can he reconcile that with who he sees himself as, you know, like as a hero, as a man? How does he live with himself? And if he doesn't, and he gives up and goes rogue and gets disavowed by MI6, then who is he then? Right? Then he's going to have MI6 constantly chasing after him. He's a rogue agent at that point. So then what? So he's really at a crossroads, and I feel like that crossroads has a lot more to do with the story that Christos Gage has been telling. Like the Gilad story has been the action element of this arc, but really the emotional element of this arc and the philosophical element of this arc is, who are we, right? And you can almost tie that in with the Dying One taking over Gilad's body, right? Like Gilad is not being true to himself. He's not able to be true to himself because he's been taken over by the Dying One. So it's a really interesting moral dilemma that Ninjak has gotten himself into. And you really got to stop and think, now what, based on the events of this issue? And I really have a feeling, you know, as much as it's metaphor to throw around things like, after this, Ninjak will never be the same. But really, I mean, if he chooses Livewire, if he chooses to go back on his word, then who is he? Not only has he broken his word, but now he's disavowed. Now he can't work for MI6 anymore. Now, how does he get his missions? How does he ensure that his powers are being used for the greater good? There's a lot of questions to be answered as we come out of the last issue of this story arc with Ninja K 14. So, a great job of storytelling by Christos Gage. I will say, and Jesse and I talked about this the last time we covered Ninja K on the Valiant Sunday episode. I'm not a big fan of Roberto De La Torre's art on Ninjak. I feel like it's just, as I said on that podcast, Ninjak is such a really fast, slick, secret agent that I feel like he needs art that's really clean in order for it to work. And the art here by De La Torre is very visceral, very sketchy, very dirty. And first of all, I don't really care for that style, but I especially think it doesn't suit a Ninjak story that well. So, but overall, I'm enjoying the story, and it's Ninjak, and this Ninja K title from Christos Gage has been spot on. It's been absolutely excellent from day one. So, the art here, it's not bad. It just, I feel like we'd be better suited with a little bit of a different artist. So, all right, let me run down real quickly some of the other titles you may want to be on the lookout for today. From Aftershock Comics, we have Dark Arc number 11 from Cullen Bunn, as well as Patience, Conviction, Revenge number 3. That was a really, really good issue. I wanted to have time to talk about it, but I'm already over an hour and I was hoping to keep it to 30 minutes. So we'll keep Patience, Conviction, Revenge for another time. Also from Ahoy Comics, I want to mention there is a second printing of Wrong Earth number 2. That Wrong Earth title is flying under a lot of people's radar, but everybody I've talked to who's read it has absolutely enjoyed it. And I have a feeling those early issues may become pretty valuable as more and more people discover Ahoy Comics. All right, over at DC, I talked about most of the titles there, but I didn't talk about Mr. Miracle number 12, which was a really interesting end to the series, and I think we're going to hold off on it and talk about Mr. Miracle 12 in a special spotlight episode, along with thoughts on the series overall. We also have Plastic Man number 6 ending that miniseries from Gail Simone and Adriana Mello, and we also have G. Willow Wilson's first issue of Wonder Woman hitting stands today, Wonder Woman number 58. Over at IDW, G.I. Joe Real American Hero 257 is out today, as well as Euthanauts number 4 from Tinny Howard. At Image, I mentioned Bitterroot number 1. We also have Hit Girl number 10 and Weatherman number 6. Over at Marvel, Avengers number 10 is out today, along with Black Order number 1 of 5. Cosmic Ghost Rider, from Donnie Cates finishes up its run with number 5 of 5 out today. Fantastic Four number 3 is on stands today. We also have the first issue of the weekly Uncanny X-Men number one, which I'll be covering on a spotlight next week. And then from Valiant, we have the Bloodshot Rising Spirit, which I already mentioned, and Ninja K number 13, which I talked about as well. So that's going to do it for this week. Hope you get out to your local comic shop and find some awesome comics to read today. Thanks for joining us, everybody. As always, please tell your friends about us. Subscribe and rate us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, Google Play, or whatever platform you use. The ratings really help with our visibility and our ability to reach new listeners, especially 5-star reviews on Apple. Also, all past episodes of the podcast are available on all those platforms, as well as at lrmonline.com. While you're at the site, please check out all the other pop culture coverage of your favorite and upcoming movies and TV shows. If you want to email us, the email address is thecomicsourceblog@gmail.com, or you can follow us on Twitter.com/thecomicsource. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three spots are great places to find out when we release new episodes, as well as follow all our convention coverage. So once again, we want to thank everybody for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.